You're listening to Local Motion, KVNF's weekly public affairs show. I'm Audra McCabe. When the Gold Mountain Fire broke out on June 27th, it spread quickly across rugged, steep terrain with incredibly dry timber that provided plenty of fuel for a crisis. While the fire has burned over the last 7 weeks, the KVNF news team has worked to bring you stories on the impacts of the fire and the people fighting it. We've learned a lot from trips down to the incident command post, tours of the fire perimeter, and conversations with firefighting personnel and Western Slope residents. On today's Local Motion, we're threading those lessons together to bring you the story of the Gold Mountain Fire. Almost immediately after the fire started, a mobile city popped up at the Ouray County Fairgrounds. That city, of sorts, housed the Gold Mountain Firefighting Operation. KVNF's Brody Wilson brings you there.
You'll see crews, even when they're going to chow, walking in line.
It's early morning at the Ouray County Fairgrounds in Ridgeway. A crew of firefighters crosses the gravel toward breakfast in a single-file line. Nobody ordered them to. It's how they move on the fire line, where your place in line is how the crew keeps count of you.
And if you stay in a line, you have accountability for every single person in your crew.
That's Christy Thompson, one of the public information officers on the Gold Mountain Fire. The crews are headed toward breakfast, and breakfast here is an operation of its own.
Right now, we are serving 900 for breakfast. And that's almost every day, too.
Shamari Bailey is the head cook. 900 breakfasts. Days ago, this was a county fairgrounds. Today, it's a town of nearly 1,000 people. Hundreds of tents, streets of office trailers, showers, laundry, its own security. This is the incident command post for the Gold Mountain Fire. I asked Bailey why he does this.
I do it because someone has to. You know, people are out there fighting the fires for us, and we got to serve them. They have to eat. You know, we got to get them bulked up.
They have to eat more than most of us can imagine.
The amount of calories that are in a day's amount is about 5,000. Because they have to go for the maximum that people would need when they're out on the fire line to ensure that they are getting the proper nutrition.
Behind the mess tent are several refrigerated semi-trailers, a supply chain that thinks days in advance.
We order in bulk, we order ahead of time. We always stay ahead of the grind, so that way when the meal comes, we're prepared to make that meal. So we have 7 meals prepared in the reefer unit.
The kitchen is just one address on what the team calls Main Street, rows of trailers where the sections work, supply, planning, medical. Tyler Nathy is one of the operations section chiefs.
Sure, so we've got the main camp here, ICP, here in Ridgeway at the fairgrounds, and we're supporting close to 700 firefighters and associated support staff out of this location. Then we also have another, what we call a spike camp, up near the Highway 50 and Cimarron Road area. Incident-wide, we're getting close to about 1,000 people. We really kind of set up a little mini town.
But none of this is improvised. When a complex incident management team gets the call, the town comes with it.
Yeah, so anytime a team that's like ours, a complex incident management team gets ordered, we have a standard set of stuff that comes with us on a pre-order, essentially. So we like to come and be as self-sufficient as possible so that we're not putting extra strain on a community when we come in.
And one of the most surprising things, there are no volunteers in this camp. Every cook, every driver, firefighter is a trained, paid professional. They've come from more than 30 states, among them a tribal crew, the Shingle Springs Band of Miwok Indians from California, and one ambulance crew getting ready to head out to the fire line to provide on-site medical care if necessary is local.
You know, it's a mobile camp, kind of like the camps they set up for military personnel overseas. It's pretty impressive logistics. They throw it all together in a day or two. There's showers, there's a chow hall, kind of like a little city.
Reuben Farnsworth is a paramedic with the ambulance service in Delta County. On the fire line, he handles the small stuff, twisted ankles, altitude sickness, and stands at the ready for the worst.
We sure appreciate your being here, and I hope you have a real boring fire.
Everybody hopes we have a boring fire. So do we. Thank you, have a good day.
This pop-up city at the Ouray County Fairgrounds exists primarily to protect resources like infrastructure and structures themselves, but also our beautiful public lands, the west, middle, and east fork of the Cimarron, for example, the places where many of us locals take our kids camping. The people protecting these lands, some of them designated wilderness areas, know what that's worth. Operations Section Chief Tyler Nathy grew up in Grand Junction. He's camped those lands with his family.
I think this is 23 years in this industry for me, and something I got into. I enjoyed being outdoors and fell into the Forest Service and started work in that, and sort of just kind of fell in love with being able to give myself to something bigger than myself.
Near the mess tent, there's an information board. Every morning, the team posts fresh maps so crews coming off the line can see the whole picture of the fire that they're fighting. And one corner of that board is saved for something else.
And then we always want to make sure any of the thank yous that we get, these are all for the folks that are out on the fire line, and we want to make sure they feel appreciated.
Today, that tent city is much, much smaller. At the fire's peak, nearly 1,000 people were involved in the operation. Now there's fewer than 100. As the fire reaches almost 90% containment, firefighting personnel and resources are able to refocus their efforts on other fires. Right now, attention is largely on the massive fires burning in the Northwest. But before the incident command post was largely packed up, we spoke to some personnel doing more behind-the-scenes work. Wildfires have held the attention of Coloradans through a brutal season fueled by drought. But despite our fixation on the flames, few of us see the complex network of people working behind the scenes to fight them. If you pictured wildfire crews as just helicopter pilots and firefighters working in the woods, you're missing a big part of the picture. At the incident command post for the Gold Mountain Fire in Ridgway, dozens of people perform jobs that are essential to the response, but rarely get much public attention.
And so our job here, you can kind of think of it like Amazon.
We get to post up maps, closures, detailed information of the incident.
So I'm learning how to work with heavy equipment under the guidance of supervisors and experienced heavy equipment bosses. So
those three voices have very different roles. Julia Pappas keeps the command post stocked. Matthew Gelati keeps the public informed. And Brandon Hoagland operates heavy equipment used to repair areas disturbed by firefighting operations. This work is not solitary. The teams and individuals fighting the fire hail from all over the country, but that doesn't mean they operate as isolated cells. At the incident command post, many roles become intertwined. Hoagland, a lieutenant with South Metro Fire Rescue outside Denver, worked this fire as a heavy equipment boss trainee. His team works closely with resource advisors, specialists who guide suppression efforts to protect natural, cultural, and heritage assets. Those specialists, who usually have a background in biology or environmental science, guide operators like Hoagland on repairing burn scars and minimizing impact.
This is on Forest Service land, so we work with the resource advisors as far as what they want it to look like and the specs. So what the guidance we got was to come in, smooth out or kind of roughen up where the bulldozer put in containment line, and then to pull the brush back over it to help control erosion. And then, so we work really closely with the resource advisors on the incident that'll tell us what this should look like when we're done.
Julia Pappas is an administrative specialist with the Mark Twain National Forest in Missouri. At the Gold Mountain Fire, she's working as a receiving and distributing manager trainee. Her role is crucial for managing the logistical supply chain in supporting the firefighting efforts.
So we take in the materials that are needed out on the line and here in camp. And then as people need something, we, package it up and we deliver it to them. Or sometimes, they'll come pick it up. We do work very closely with ground support. So their trailer is actually right next to ours because they're the ones that provide the drivers to take stuff out into the field.
And the collaboration doesn't stop at the command post. Gelati says every person working on the fire has another network of people supporting them back home.
Not just my wife, Olivia, or my kiddo, Penelope, but my family, my mom, sister, siblings, all my family, they jump in to help support her. And then on top of that, my home unit too, they're taking care of staffing my position too. So to have You know, it's one person going out to another community, but behind that scenes, behind the curtain, you don't see the tens of hundreds of people that are supporting that role. So huge shout out to the families out there, for everybody from the firefighters online to, you know, the incident commander, logistics, radio comms, everybody that does stuff here. They got somebody else back home helping take care of, I wouldn't say the slack, but taking care of that work that just needs to be done.
From the people repairing containment lines to those keeping the command post stocked and the families supporting them back home, wildfire response depends on far more people than those we think of on the fire line. It's a vast network of people with wildly different skills, backgrounds, and responsibilities, all working together to keep each other safe and protect our communities. There's another side to this story. What happens when the work becomes deadly? While many people supporting the Gold Mountain Fire never set foot on the fire line, others faced the dangers of firefighting firsthand. In July, a helicopter pilot working on the fire died when his aircraft crashed into the Silverjack Reservoir. His body was later escorted through Montrose by a procession. The crowd was solemn as a line of emergency vehicles passed. The procession was escorting the body of Nicholas Dale, a helicopter pilot who died while fighting the Gold Mountain Fire. The first responders drove by with stoic expressions and their eyes on the road ahead of them. But there was palpable emotion among the residents watching.
When you have people that are brave enough to risk their lives to help us and make life better for us, you can't help but be on this lineup with all these flags and get teary-eyed because a young man gave his life in order to protect us. And so it's meaningful.
That was Montrose County Commissioner Sue Hansen. The Board of Commissioners actually delayed their meeting yesterday morning in order to attend the procession. Dale, the pilot, was a 56-year-old man from Sooke, British Columbia. He was the sole occupant of the helicopter, which was engaged in suppression efforts for the Gold Mountain Fire. The aircraft went down shortly after 5 p.m. Sunday evening and crashed into the Silverjack Reservoir. Commissioner Kirsten Copeland found meaning in the procession's attendance.
I think it reflects the Montrose community, how much our first responders mean to all of us. You know, my husband is a police officer, and I know that firefighters, police officer, wildland firefighters, all of those folks put themselves at risk every day to protect us, and I think this community recognizes that and shows up.
The crash is currently being investigated by the National Transportation Safety Board and the Federal Aviation Administration. You're listening to Local Motion on KBNF. This week, we're bringing you the story of the Gold Mountain Fire. So far, we've heard about the complex operation behind wildfire fighting and the people who make it happen, whether they're working behind the scenes or battling the flames directly. In the rest of this episode, you'll hear about how language shapes our relationship with wildfires, what the inside of the fire perimeter looks like right now, and the work that's left to be done. We know that wildfires can be deadly, but the reality is that fire is a part of this landscape, and the language we use to describe it affects our relationship with it.
When we speak about fire, commonly, we use negative language. We use scar, we use scorched, we use words that have high emotional value, typically negatively.
Kevin Sweeney is a public information officer working on the Gold Mountain Fire. While showing KVNF containment lines, he stops us before we get too close to a blackened tree. He points out a flag that says "killer tree," indicating that it could easily fall. In these situations, harsh language can be useful. A negative term like burn scar helps people understand that the area is dangerous. But outside those immediate safety warnings, Sweeney says that same language can shape how people think about every kind of fire, including the prescribed burns that help reduce future wildfire risk.
One of the hurdles we have to get over with getting more beneficial fire on the landscape is reducing the fear of fire in our communities. We need more fire in the West. And that's a really hard thing to say when you're driving through a 40,000-acre fire that almost burned down a town that I got married in.
Instinct tells us that fires need to be put out immediately. But when it comes to wildfires, the answer isn't quite so simple.
If you think back to when pioneers were moving across the land, and then later on, fire bad, don't ever have it, because European settlers were coming from places where fires, they only burned downtowns. Whereas our Ute friends and our other Native friends, they would come up into these mands and hunt and then migrate down into lower valleys, but they would light fires behind them where they left so that they could have good hunting grounds. And so there was this balance and understanding of the importance of valley and value of fire. And where we have been for the past 150 years with the mindset of put every fire out is why we have a Gold Mountain fire, why we have a Dixie fire, why we have a Paradise campfire. It's because of our fear of fire instead of understanding how fire is a natural part of this place.
Sweeney recognizes that changing the way people think or speak about fire isn't easy, especially after a summer like this.
You know, living without fire here is the same as living without snow. If we eliminate fire, we dramatically impact the landscape and we dramatically turn it for the worse. So just like we don't really want to stop the snow, we don't really want to stop the fire. But it's really uncomfortable to say that when we're so close to it having a potential tremendously negative impact. So,
for Sweeney, changing how we manage fire starts with changing how we talk about it. Because if every fire is seen only as destructive, he says it becomes much harder to use carefully planned fires that can help prevent the next disaster. Once the fire had reached sufficient containment, KVNF was given access to the fire perimeter. We were some of the first non-firefighting personnel to see the area. Amid the spotty green and black areas, we were relieved to report that much of the land remains untouched. Brody Wilson has the story of our trip up Owl Creek Pass. While the immediate danger of the fire seems to have passed, the work isn't done when the flames are out.
Decent lumber that's been kiln dried. Legally, it has to be 12% or lower. Mm-hmm. So that's 2x4s that have been cut up, sent to the kiln, dried out, and now they're ready to get bought at your favorite lumber store. We're seeing some of our living trees here in the Uncompahgre at 9%.
Living trees that are drier than kiln dried lumber.
That's Kevin Sweeney, an information officer on the Gold Mountain Fire, when he took the KVNF news team into the burned perimeter of the fire. And he was helping KVNF News understand why the fire behaved the way it did, why some areas burnt, well, like wildfire, and other areas didn't burn at all. If you live in the Uncompahgre Valley, you've spent much of this summer watching flames and smoke roll through the southeast corner of our valley. Iconic country in front of Courthouse and Chimney and behind it. I've been going up there my whole life to camp and hike and hunt for mushrooms. But from down in the valley, it's hard to tell what's actually burning up there. Really, all any of us could see was the red-shaped fire boundary on a map that, if you're like me, we've been checking incessantly all summer long. So when the KVNF news team was able to drive up Owl Creek Pass with fire officials, I went up there expecting a moonscape.
Because you see red doesn't mean it's black, right? Like, the red is just that area within the fire. I mean, we're looking into that red area right now, and there's perfectly green trees that have no impact to them.
It isn't a moonscape up there. One hillside is black, yes, and then the next one over is green, and that holds for miles. So how does a forest this dry burn like that?
And even like a pine cone can get carried by some of those 30, 40 mile an hour gusts, land in a pile of receptive fuel, and then climb its way up to a tree. That tree torches, more wind gets on it, torches other trees, and then you have that high severity, high intensity burn.
That's the fire we watched from town and could see from down in the valley, but it didn't do that everywhere, and one of the reasons is one particular tree. Remember that 9% moisture content? That came from a fire behavior analyst, and the one on this fire made a video for the incident's own channel on this fire's behavior.
I'm Glenn Lewis, and I'm a fire behavior analyst with Rocky Mountain Incident Management Team 1, and we're here managing the Gold Mountain and Elk fires in southwestern Colorado.
I'll post a link to this full video on the web post for this piece at kvnf.org.
So then that brings us to the Aspen, our firefighter's friend, right? So the first thing that I want to point out is that the very composition of how Aspen trees and Aspen stands are built is fundamentally different.
Lewis gives three reasons on why Aspen trees are important for fire behavior. And the first one is the shape of the tree. Picture a spruce with its branches down to the dirt. And aspen doesn't do that.
Aspen trees tend to shoot up very quickly, reaching towards the sun, and they tend to shed these lower branches as they grow and get taller.
So there's no ladder from the ground up into the crown. The second reason is what's lying on the floor of an aspen stand. Picture the aspens that you drive through going up Owl Creek Pass. They have these beautiful ferns that are down on the ground throughout.
In the fall, when the leaves are shed off from the aspen stand, they tend to form a dense mat, and that kind of traps some moisture in the soil, upper soil moisture here, and that helps encourage this herbaceous material to grow in here. So, and this herbaceous material holds a lot of moisture in it, and it's very inhibitive to fire spread.
And this third reason is one that kind of surprised me.
Aspen leaves tend to hold a lot of moisture in them, and the one thing that really makes them different from all the other species that we were talking about today is that they don't have the volatile oils within the needles or within the leaves that even the oak trees have that makes them want to burn more intensely. It's kind of like pouring gasoline on fire. The aspen leaves are almost like a little bit of sprinkling of water in the fact that they have a bunch of moisture that's absorbing heat rather than contributing to heat.
So aspen leaves are like a wet blanket for a fire, and pine needles are like gasoline. In that same video, Lewis walks through aerial photos of the fire, pointing at the green patches inside the burn, and he says that a lot of those patches are aspen.
It kind of parted ways almost when it came to the aspen stand here and burned through this mixed conifer very intensely through some spots up in front of it, but the aspen kind of held it, and you can see it took a bunch of the heat out when it did come over here.
So the green that you can see up there probably isn't luck, or at least not all of it. Some of it is aspen doing what aspen do. And Kevin Sweeney says that those burned patches should come back next summer with wildflowers, because fire puts nitrogen back in the ground.
You have a nice mosaic pattern where there was some impact, but then others where there wasn't. And honestly, like, this is not a good fire by any means, but there's patches of good within the fire.
We drove past the draw where my family cuts our Christmas tree most years, and some of it had burned. I admitted to feeling pretty sad about that, and Sweeney acknowledged the loss that I was feeling and that many will feel when they re-enter this burned area.
And you know, I think there's going to be some of that grieving for the next while with, you know, you guys and your community, to where you're going to that fishing spot that your grandpa took you to, and now it looks different, and that sucks.
While the immediate danger of the fire seems to have passed, the work isn't done when the flames are out.
The way that they've managed these incidents has changed a lot over the last, you know, several decades. But, you know, long after the smoke column is gone, there's still a lot of work being done.
If you live in the Uncompahgre Valley, you've spent much of this summer watching smoke rise off the Cimarron country, where many of us camp and hunt and cut our Christmas trees. A lot of us call it our church, our cathedral. Last week, the KVNF news team rode up Owl Creek Pass, and we were among the first back in the fire area. And I expected a moonscape, but it isn't one. The burn is spotty. One hillside blacked, the next one green. Mostly, what I felt up there was relief. The voice you heard belongs to Brandon Hoagland, a lieutenant with South Metro Fire Rescue on the south side of Denver. This fire quit growing over the last couple of weeks, and yet the mountain is still full of people working. Brandon's assignment, a fire line his crews are here to erase.
It's about 1,000 feet of control line that was put in.
A bulldozer cut it during the fight. A strip wider than a two-lane road scraped down to bare dirt, so the fire starves when it gets there. And it worked. The fire stopped at this point. Then the line became a wound in the forest.
Smooth out or kind of roughen up where the bulldozer put in containment line, and then to pull the brush back over it to help control erosion.
At least two crews and at least two visits. One crew dug it, another came back to put it away. And what put it away means isn't the operator's call. There's a specialist for that.
Yeah, the resource advisors, they usually have some kind of a background in biology or in environmental sciences, so they kind of help us decide what's going to be best for rehabbing the ground and keeping it from being a scar, minimizing the impact as much as possible.
Resource advisors write the spec for how the fire lines are to be restored, then they check the work. The Incident Command Zone report this week said that advisors were out confirming repairs were finished, quote, in a satisfactory manner. This is what's changed over Hoagland's time working wildfires. repair has stopped being an afterthought. The same promise of restoration extends to private ground. The field near the turn to drive back Owl Creek was where crews for this division staged every morning, and it belongs to a local rancher and was used under an agreement. The fire pays for its time on the land, and before it leaves, it regrades the torn-up road, reseeds the pasture, regravels the driveway.
You know, Ridgeway's been a great host to us and put up with a large presence here for a long time.
All of that work is to make the mountain and the forest whole again, but none of it makes the mountain safe. And safety is by far the top priority. We had to gear up in fireproof clothing and hard hats, and we weren't going anywhere near a flame. And our visit was highly coordinated within the chain of command.
Division Foxtrot, PIO Sweeney.
PIO Sweeney, Foxtrot, command, go ahead.
We are escorting two members of the media in my vehicle, a blue Ford Expedition, heading to Owl Creek Vista. Break.
I copy that, thank you.
The man who drove us through the burn said it plainly.
Yeah, my name's Kevin Sweeney. I'm the information officer with the Complex Incident Management Team that's here right now on the Gold Mountain Fire. Yeah, and a recently burned area is a dangerous place. And there's a dangerous place for a number of reasons. Flash flooding, like we've seen over the past few days. Hazard trees, weakened trees from the soil being burned near the tree and then getting moisture. So the tree might look healthy, but its root system might be damaged.
Picture a tree full of green needles, but with charcoal roots. You probably can't see that from the road, but a specialist can. And there's an order to what gets cleared first.
So the land managers for this area, the Forest Service, will come in. They'll remove hazard trees near the road. So once that's safe to do, they'll reopen the road. But they won't get to all of the hazard trees for the whole forest. They'll focus on the roads, then they'll focus on trails.
We were about halfway up Owl Creek, and we stopped to look at a particularly burned section of forest. And I got out and started toward the edge of a burn for a photo. And Sweeney stopped me. The snag ahead was flagged, and the flagging spells out killer tree. He wouldn't walk under it either.
I don't want to walk up in there. I got kids. So it literally says killer tree.
So picture this fall. The gates open, and all of us head back up there to hunt and cut a Christmas tree and hike our favorite trail. But
on a windy day, if you're walking in areas where it's burned, look for those signs that maybe this isn't too safe and pay attention to that, you know, hair on the back of your neck, kind of feeling a little bit like maybe I should get out of here. Listen to that.
And if the road that you want to drive stays gated into this fall,
Forest Service might take their time in opening it up too. So respect that. Those closures aren't in place because we want to keep folks out of here. Well, they are in place because we want to keep folks out of here. It's not that we don't want them to enjoy their land. It's that there's some pretty serious hazards back here, and there's a reason that that area is closed.
That's where we are today. Evacuation zones are standing down and neighbors are starting to go home, but the forest above us is still closed because the work up there isn't finished.
The folks are still here working, even though there's not a lot of smoke in the air, so.
For the past 7 weeks, the Gold Mountain Fire has changed our landscape and the way many of us see it. As crews move on and the incident command post disappears, the work of understanding what happened and what comes next continues. This has been KVNF's Local Motion. If you weren't able to catch the full episode, you can find it at kvnf.org under the Local Motion tab, on Apple Podcasts, or on Spotify. I'm Audra McCabe.